Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. Welcome everyone to episode 96 of Brains Matter. On today's show, I have an interview with Dr. Ginger Campbell from the Brain Science Podcast on the topic of the brain. G'day everyone and welcome to another episode of Brains Matter. Dr. Virginia Campbell, MD, is an emergency physician in North Alabama in the United States and is also a keen science communicator, especially in the field of brain science. Coincidentally, she's also the host of the Brain Science Podcast, and for those listeners out there who are listening to the Brains Matter podcast through the sciencepodcasters.org feed, you also have Ginger to thank for that. So welcome to the show, Ginger.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you're here by popular demand. There's been quite a few listeners out there who've been asking for you to appear on the show.
Well, thanks. And I want to thank you for all the support you've given me on sciencepodcasters.org.
And more than welcome. So today we're going to go through a couple of topics, brain chemistry, plasticity, and brain imaging. So we're just going to have a bit of a general run through on that. And I'm sure that if listeners are interested in some of the more detailed aspects of that, they can come and listen to your show. So could you let the listeners know where they can find your show if they haven't already subscribed?
Yes, it's at, do you mind me saying that I actually do have two podcasts, one of which is not in sciencepodcasters.org. So I have the Brain Science Podcast. I have another show called Books and Ideas, which is where I put the stuff that doesn't quite fit on the Brain Science Podcast. And you can find both of those if you go to gingercampbellmd.com.
Okay.
G-I-N-G-E-R Campbell is spelled C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L-M-D.com.
All right. So first off, let's talk a little bit about brain chemistry. So in a bit of a nutshell, what is the topic of brain chemistry and why is it interesting for us as people or for people in the medical field?
Well, usually when I'm talking about this on my show, I class it under what we call neurotransmitters, which covers the idea that there are chemical messengers in the brain. There's a large number of basically types of proteins that are active in the brain. They interact at the synapse and tell the synapse, they'll excite or inhibit a given neuron. And then within the neuron itself, even other chemicals are carrying messages. Most people have heard about this in terms of things like depression. A very simplistic model that we used about 20 years ago was the idea that people with depression were lacking in normal levels of certain neurotransmitters. And most of the commercial antidepressants are based on this model and based on the idea that they could help you to have higher levels of certain brain chemicals and that will help your depression. I think the biggest take-home point I would want to communicate is that it's a lot more complicated than that. It's not necessarily just because one of your chemicals is low. The other thing is that because all these chemicals are involved in the synapse, which is the connection between neurons, you cannot think of but it's a very big oversimplification to think of the brain as a computer, because a computer is, most of our computers are digital, which means simple one-on-one connections between the parts. In the brain, the connections between neurons are much more complicated than that. Whether a given neuron will fire is the result of the combination of chemical signals it receives from all the other neurons that it's connected to. That chemical part is one of the things that makes it different from a digital computer.
Okay, in terms of the computer analogy there, I know that in computer science they talk about artificial intelligence trying to model the brain and so on. And as you just mentioned, there's always a state of either zero or one with those synapses that you were talking about. Is it always a case of firing or not firing, or are there multiple possibilities?
Well, you do have the case of firing or not firing in terms of whether or not the given neuron to other neurons, what's known as the action potential. The thing about the action potential is every neuron's action potential looks the same. That's the part that looks digital, on or off.
Mm-hmm.
But what determines whether that action potential happens has to do with the electrical properties of the neuron at that given moment. Things like what is the charge right then on the inside versus the outside? How close is it to firing? Those of you who have taken any kind of biology these days, you know that all cells have channels in their walls that things like sodium go in and out of. So whether these channels are open or closed will determine whether or not the charge on the inside of the cell is near to the place it needs to be to fire or not. So I'll give you an example of what I meant when I said it's more complex than just the wiring diagram. I just interviewed Dr. Eve Martyr, who was just president of the Society for Neuroscience. She has spent 35 years studying what's called the somatogastric ganglion inside the lobster. A ganglion is a collection of neurons. This is a collection of neurons in the stomach of the lobster that consists of 30 neurons. Those 30 neurons are the same. They know exactly which neurons those are in every lobster. In fact, there's one called the LP neuron that there's exactly one of in every lobster. And what she's discovered is that they have the entire wiring diagram as opposed to, like, we don't have the entire wiring diagram for the brain, not even for of a simple animal. And they've discovered that even though the wiring diagram, they know exactly what it is, they can look at this single neuron. And what they found is things like those channels are very variable from lobster to lobster. Even in a given lobster, that neuron will change which, how many channels there are will change. It turns out that there is a lot more variability than anyone ever imagined at that level, which brings into doubt the whole idea that if we had the wiring diagram for our brain, it would be enough to allow us to simulate it with a computer.
Or even make predictions, I guess. So if, as an analogy, what you're saying is if someone comes out with a particular kind of computer, if it acted like the brain and the wiring that we have in biology, then every single computer with the same stimulus could act differently.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the other thing is, let's say you have the wiring diagram and you have figured out how to simulate, say, a neuron, simulate its all the channels and things that are going to determine its state. Well, that's a constantly changing thing, too. So as opposed to a computer where once you know how things are hooked up, you expect that you're going to get the same result every time, as you said, every time you put the same thing in, you expect to get the same result out. Not that simple for brains.
You might design that particular computer and purchase it, and then the computer is self-aware is probably not the best term, but it has the capability to rewire itself depending on what outside stimulus it has.
Yeah, if a computer could do that. So what I'm trying to say is there's actually two pieces to the fact that the brain changes, which I think was something we were going to come to. It's not just the fact that the wiring diagram can change in terms of getting new synapses. Many people are now aware of that fact, that the wiring diagram can change, which we can't really simulate very well yet, but except on, well, the people that are working in artificial intelligence are working at the level of trying to simulate the changing wiring diagram. But I don't think anyone's gotten to the next stage, which is what Dr. Martyr's work is telling us we're going to need to do, which is actually figuring out how to simulate how the individual neuron is going to change. We tend to use what I would call the computer metaphor for understanding the brain, and it's a very limited metaphor. The more we learn about how our brains really work, the more we see that the computer metaphor is insufficient in a lot of ways.
The way that, you know, as we've already discussed, the way they've done the computer simulation for learning is based on a predicted input giving a predicted output and expected state, so whether it was a zero or a one. And the same situation will give you the same result. So that's one. Same situation will give you the same result. And two, there is only the on or the off switch, and that will give you your memory. And the memory is something they use to lead on to learning, which I think are two totally separate concepts.
in terms of learning, not only that is one of the limits of the artificial intelligence approach. And think about the fact that when 20 years or 30 years ago, that it was kind of assumed, maybe 30 would be a closer estimate, that it would be easy to teach a computer to do something like perception and hard to teach it to do something like chess. And it's turned out to be exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Chess is something that they've been able to solve by doing it in a way that's not the way we really do it. But perception still is very challenging. I mean, we can look at a person and, you know, see them in a shadow, see them far away, see them close up, and figure out exactly who they are. Whereas things like face recognition software, although it's improving, is still easily fooled by small changes, which, you know, shows that there's something a lot more complicated about how our brain does perception than what they have tried to do with artificial intelligence.
And going back to some of the stuff we were talking about before, in terms of depression and mood and so on, you said that it's a lot more complicated than just having a certain deficiency in particular chemicals or synapses in the brain. But if someone has a particular difference in their brain chemistry compared to someone else, is that more likely to lead them to a condition like depression?
I don't think that I'm qualified to answer that question, and I'm not even sure whether we know for sure, but we certainly do work under the assumption that that seems to be true from our relatively limited knowledge at this point in time. But when I said it was more complicated, think about this. Think about how if you're feeling depressed, I mean, most of us, even if we don't have clinical depression, sometimes are, you know, feel a little blue or whatever, and think about how just being able to have the sense that there's something you can do about it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's very easy to explain if you just say that it's just chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Well, have we observed the flip side of that, and that is, depending on how you feel, a difference in the amount of particular chemicals in your brain, so the other way around?
That's kind of sometimes makes you think of science fiction, though, because like they figured out that if they spray rooms with oxytocin, people will be more trusting and more likely to fall for con men. And they've actually done experiments that show this, because oxytocin is a neurotransmitter that seems to promote bonding, feelings of bonding. And that's kind of, to me, that's a little bit scary to think that you could go, say, into a car dealership and you don't know that they've laced the room with oxytocin, and all of a sudden this guy that you would have recognized was just a used car salesman, suddenly you feel this mysterious trust for him. No one's actually done this yet, but right now I think it's at the science fiction level, but they have done experiments that make this look like it's something that could be. It would make a believable science fiction story.
So is that something in the area of this could be true, or is it an accepted fact, as it were?
Well, they have done experiments with oxytocin, you know, where they then do these sort of economic, would you do this or that kind of simulation games, and shown that it really does affect people's behavior. Now, as far as how generalizable that would be, that would be at the level, that's where it becomes a level of speculation.
So,
but I'm referring to an actual experiment.
So how would a neurotransmitter, let's just talk about it in a generalized form, how does a neurotransmitter actually work? What does it actually do within the brain?
Well, what it does is it interacts with something on the surface of a neuron, or actually it's only called a neurotransmitter when it's interacting with a neuron. Dopamine, which you may have heard of because it's been in the news, is a chemical in the body that in other parts of the body is a chemical messenger in other ways besides being a neurotransmitter. But when it's a neurotransmitter, what that means is that it reaches a neuron and connects with what's called a receptor, kind of a lock and key is the way people usually think of it, as simplified. So it reaches that receptor, it causes the receptor to change. This usually involves changing its shape in such a way that it leads to a chain reaction of some sort inside the neuron. This may cause it to release other chemicals in the neuron may send messages, for example, to the nucleus to tell it to make new proteins, as in the case of making a memory. And so the receptor is actually more important in a way than the neurotransmitter, because that's what makes it possible for the same receptor, such as dopamine, to have possibly hundreds of different effects in the body depending on the particular receptor that it is interacting with.
So does that imply that there are multiple different types of receptors, or the receptor changes depending on the need, as opposed to the neurotransmitter chemical being useful for a specified purpose?
There are many different kinds of receptors, and I think also that the receptors can change. But for example, going back to dopamine, what I want to say is most of the neurotransmitters that we have are very, very ancient, been around, many of them, since the days of the yeast. Okay, so what they can do becomes much more complex as the animal becomes more complex. That's partly a result of having many different kinds of receptors, also a lot of other reasons, but that's one of the reasons. So, for example, dopamine, if you don't, there's a certain place in the brain called the substantia nigra that makes a lot of dopamine that's used in movement. And if you don't have, if those neurons that make that dopamine die, you get something called Parkinson's disease. So in that situation, you need the dopamine to have normal movement. However, if you have too much dopamine in certain parts of your brain, you may have schizophrenia, a disease of too little, a disease of too much. So then when you try to make a drug, for example, to treat Parkinson's disease, you can have side effects from the extra dopamine you're trying to get into the person's brain going to the other places and causing the effects of too much. And that's really why I said when we first started that something like depression is much more than just chemicals, and why designing drugs to treat illnesses that are aimed at these neurotransmitters is a lot more complicated than you might think at first glance.
It does certainly sound very complicated. We approached the topic of plasticity before. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what that is?
Plasticity is the idea that our brains are constantly changing, and this change is actually happening on many different levels. It's happening at the level of the neurotransmitters. It's happening at the level of the neurons. It's happening at the level of the receptors and other things going on in the neurons. It's happening at the level of the wiring between the neurons or the synapses. So our brains are not static, which again is one of the challenges of trying to simulate them. This is really exciting, though, because it means that if you get brain damage for some reason, your chances of having recovery are much higher than was ever imagined.
There's been discussion about age and plasticity, so whether the amount of recovery capability when you're older, for example, is the same as when you're younger.
Well, it's definitely not as much when you're older as it is when you're younger. I mean, we know this clinically from this point of view that if a really young child, say under the age of 5, has a brain injury, their chances of having recovery, total recovery, where you may not even be able to see any deficits at all, are relatively good. Past that age, you expect to see some permanent deficits, and as a person gets older, the ability to recover continues to go down. But the point is, it's not ever zero. Mm-hmm. You always have some plasticity. And this is not just about making new neurons, although it does turn out there's a few places in the brain where we even make new neurons. For the most part, the plasticity doesn't rely on making new neurons. It has to do with new wiring and changing what the neurons we've already have are doing. You can do this we know that in blind people, the visual cortex, the part of the brain that would normally do vision, it doesn't just sit there doing nothing. It takes over other tasks related to hearing and touch. It turns out that people who read Braille actually use the visual cortex to do that. In fact, I remember reading a story of a patient who had a stroke involving that part of the brain. They didn't become blind because they were already blind, but they lost the ability to read Braille.
Oh, wow.
And the surprising thing is how rapidly this happens. People have done experiments where they blindfolded people with normal sight and started teaching them to do Braille, and they were able to see this change within about a week. So what that tells us is that it's not necessarily entirely new wiring, but maybe something like unmasking wiring that was there that we weren't using. And the reason I say that is if it was new wiring, it would take longer. It takes longer than that to make new wiring in terms of making new proteins and growing new synapses. So to see a change within a few days implies that it's not new wiring. Now, new wiring is important. I'm not saying new wiring is not important, but what I'm saying is that there's more to it than that.
To me, that sounds like there's a large linkage between learning and the plasticity aspect of it, because I do know, and you know, most listeners out there have probably heard people say it's a lot easier learning a new language when you're young, and languages aren't just necessarily different words for the same concept, but there are different syntaxes, there's different grammar, there's different thinking even. So the type of thinking you do, I know that people who are bilingual actually say sometimes, I don't know how to say that in English because there's no equivalent. So there's actually a different type of thinking. When you're young, you find that kids pick up another language far more quickly than those who are a lot older.
That's a really good area, because it brings up one of the controversies that's still going on about language. There's a lot of controversies about language, but there are those who believe that we have an innate language module in the brain, and that what happens is we start out with somehow the ability. Well, we know we'd start out with this. It's just how we do it is the part that's a controversy. But a small child can learn any language. Obviously, they automatically learn whatever language their parents speak. And if they're adopted, they learn a different language. So it's not like you come wired with Japanese because you have Japanese parents. It's definitely true that the ability to do languages is hard. Learning new languages is harder. But if you took the language module approach, say a really good book by Steven Pinker, The Language Instinct, which I read before I started doing this podcast, and he studied under Chomsky and takes this sort of brain module approach. If you read something like that, you'd say, well, there's no point in trying to learn a foreign language now that I'm over 30, because it's hopeless. And you'd sort of take the kind of, well, that's why I can't do it. Why bother? Mm. But if you come at it from the plasticity point of view, then you say, okay, it's harder. There's no arguing with the fact that it's harder, but I can do it. I have to work harder. So that's what an implication of plasticity is. It's really not, it takes away our excuse, I can't do that. I can't learn to do that because I'm too old.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's, and I've talked to a lot of people in this area, obviously, on my show, and they all agree that the secret of success as you get older is to keep on learning new things and keep on challenging yourself and not let that fact that it's not easy like it was when you were young stop you from learning new things.
You're never too old to learn a new language or a new instrument.
Yeah, I just started watching this show on iTunes U, the course that they're teaching at Stanford on how to program the iPhone. And I haven't done any computer programming since the days of punch cards stressed about. And so, you know. The only problem is, when am I going to find time to learn this new skill I would like to do?
But this language module concept you were just talking about, I can see that similar kind of philosophy going across multiple areas. So one that comes to mind is, you were talking about iPhones and computers just now, using computers. I know there's a lot of people out there who have grown up with Windows, and a lot of my students, they're used to Windows, I guess, and I bring a Macintosh into the classroom and they all sort of groan at it. When I ask them to use something, or, you know, any random person who's used to Windows to do something on the Mac, they find it difficult. Not because it's difficult, but because it's not what they're used to. The paradigm is different. They're probably using the wrong phrase again, but they're wired to think in a particular way. Whereas I, for example, I've come from a background of multiple different computers. I've used everything from a Commodore 64 to Unix to Linux to Windows to Mac of all different flavors. So for me, to do something, there might be a different method of doing it, but I can quickly find my way of doing it. And my kids, for example, they just naturally go and do whatever they know that works.
Yeah, I'm reading this book called by Don Tapscott called Grown Up Digital. And one of the things he talks about in there is how kids don't ever read the instructions. Like for a computer game, they just go in and play the game. And, you know, but it is about habits. And a way to look at habits, and I didn't invent this. I got this from Dr. Norman Doidge, who wrote the book The Brain That Changes Itself. He said that it's kind of like thinking about what happens when you go skiing and you get there and the snow is new and fresh and you ski down and you set, you know, go whatever route you want to, and it's easy. But as you go down the slope and people go down a certain way, there gets to be ruts in the snow, and it's easier to stay in the ruts than it is to set up a new path after a while. And he said he calls this the dark side of brain plasticity, because it's plasticity that also makes it possible for us to get those ruts. Yeah. But plasticity also means that we can't, in my opinion, use those ruts as an excuse. But I say that over and over, because the focus of my show is, well, what does knowing about the brain mean for you as a person? And that's why I'm excited about neuroplasticity, because you don't have to know a thing about neurons or synapses or neurotransmitters to appreciate that plasticity means that you can learn new things, you can get new habits, no matter how old you are, and that as you get older, making a concentrated, intentional effort to learn new things is important.
I remember watching a documentary a few years ago. I don't remember the exact details of the case, but they were looking at a patient who had a rather large brain tumor, and the tumor was so large that it actually occupied areas of the brain which should have caused particular conditions like I'm making this up, but for example, blindness or deafness or something
right.
like that. But there were particular things which they would normally expect because the tumor had affected that area of the brain. But this person was, for all intents and purposes, a perfectly normal person. Unless they actually did a scan, they wouldn't have known that the person had a very large tumor in their head. And what they were explaining in this documentary was that the wiring of the brain had modified itself such that all of the normal processes were actually done using different pathways.
Exactly. And thinking about this on a more practical level, there's a famous study, I think it's usually known as the Nunn study, where they did autopsies on a bunch of nuns, and they found that a lot of, and these were very healthy, active nuns. None of them had any known Alzheimer's disease, but they found that some of them clinically did. They had the changes of their brain. I mean, sorry, clinically is the wrong word. Pathologically on their autopsies, they had signs of dementia that didn't show up in their daily life because they were so active. Now, that does not mean that you can't get dementia if you make sure you learn new things every day, because unfortunately, if you have very, very advanced dementia but past a certain point, it's not protective. But it is protective up to a certain point. I mean, the more active your brain is, the more making new connections, then you have more reserve, I guess, might be a way of looking at it. So I know a lot of people in the middle-aged group are worried about Alzheimer's disease because they look at their parents and their grandparents and they think, oh my God, I think that's the worst possible thing that could happen to me. I don't want it to happen. And we don't really have prevention now, but being mentally active does seem to make a difference.
So how much of a difference does that make? Because, you know, you hear people saying, you know, do the Sudoku every day, or you know, play a bit of chess. And I know a lot of people who use Facebook are addicted to that chess game, including myself. So are these really good for you? How much of a difference do they make?
Well, I don't think that we really have the data to answer that. There is, most of the people working in this field seem to think that things like chess and Sudoku, things that you do the same type of thing over and over, are beneficial, but not as beneficial as learning a new skill such as playing an instrument or learning a new language. In other words, doing something that's of a real applicability in your life is actually better for your brain than doing the crossword puzzle every day. The thing is, that becomes its own rut. And we're talking about stimulating plasticity. You need to be, I mean, Sudoku is fine when you're first figuring out how it works, but once you got into a routine where you know that this is the sort of algorithm that I take every time I work a Sudoku puzzle, then its plastic value really goes down.
So it almost sounds like once you've figured something out, then it's time to move on to something new.
Exactly. And if you talk to, I mean, the most fascinating scientists are the ones, to me, are the ones that went from one thing to another. I mean, think of Francis Crick. I mean, he got the Nobel Prize for DNA, but he spent the last 20 years of his life studying the brain. I mean, he didn't stay in that field. And Richard Feynman is another famous example who unfortunately died of cancer. He, if you ever read any of his autobiographies, he was a fascinating character because he was always learning new things. He went to Brazil one time for a year and learned to speak Portuguese. He learned to play the bongos. He learned actually to become a good enough painter to actually sell paintings. He didn't just do physics.
That reminds me of a set of interviews I did a few months ago with Professor Roger Short from the University of Melbourne. He was a vet, then he became an expert in gynecology, and he was also an expert in elephants. And without giving too much away, he is definitely well over the retiring age. And in my conversations with him, he was brighter than most 25-year-olds that you'd bump into every day on the street. He was as sharp as a tack.
Yeah, and I loved those interviews, and I was glad that you had him back on and talked to him some more, because I've always loved elephants, but I didn't know any of that stuff. It was really fascinating stuff.
I also found that I learned a lot in my discussions with him, and it was like having a conversation with someone who was my age rather than almost twice my age. The thing is, the age aspect didn't matter. What I found him very inspirational. What I felt through my conversations with him was that he would become interested in a particular topic and then learn about it, not only learn about it, but become an expert in the area, and then learn about something new, then become an expert in that area, and so on. So if you have a look at his biography at the Melbourne University website, it's just, you know, it's pretty astounding what he knows and what he's achieved. And I think that's what you're talking about in terms of plasticity and age. As long as you keep that new learning happening and there's an ongoing creation of new pathways and new types of thinkings, and I think there's a creativity aspect of it as well, because you're talking about algorithms versus something new. If there's that creative aspect in your learning, then that's probably going to help you as well. I'm saying probably as if I'm an expert, but I'm not, of course, but this is what I'm understanding from what we've been saying.
And the thing is, it's very tempting to do what's familiar, because, and this probably relates to brain chemistry too, because our brains are prediction machines, and they do give us a squirt of probably dopamine every time we predict right. So when you're doing something familiar, you kind of get some positive feedback, if you might say, of the fact that, yes, you did it and it turned out like you expected it to. And learning to do something new can feel uncomfortable. There's no doubt about that. And so you have to be willing to put up with that discomfort of sort of that, you know, first day of school, the bad part of the first day of school feeling. You have to be willing to put up with that. And as we get older and we have so many things that we are familiar with and we know our shortcuts, and it's just easy to get in those little ruts and not want to look stupid and not want to be a beginner. All those things can be obstacles to doing what's really going to allow us to tap into our plasticity.
But once you do that new thing, your brain rewards you anyway, doesn't it? So, for example, if I was to say to you, I don't want to speak in front of 300 people tomorrow because I'm really nervous, the expectation part is the worst part of it. Once I actually go and do it, afterwards, I actually feel really good.
Right. That's a good point.
I'm sure you and I both are familiar with that in terms of our podcasting as well.
Well, yeah, actually, yeah. Podcasting is a great way to learn a bunch of new skills, unless you started out in radio, which most of us didn't.
Let's get on to the topic of brain imaging. And firstly, could you tell the listeners what brain imaging is and how it relates to what we've been talking about?
One of the things that has revolutionized neuroscience in the last couple of decades is brain imaging, and in particular, CT scans, and especially the what's known as the NMR or MRI, which is a nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. And the reason that that's been so revolutionary is that this is a method that allows us to see even the what we call soft tissues of the brain, and the very small structures of the brain can be distinguished. So at the level of the CT scan, you can tell whether a person's got bleeding in their brain, you can tell whether or not they have a brain tumor, but you can't see smaller stuff and you can't see activity. With the MRI, they now have something called the functional MRI, which allows them to basically what they're measuring is blood flow in different areas of the brain over time. And so they can tell indirectly what parts of the brain are most active. And so what this means is it's now possible to show, for example, that when we have this blindfolded person doing Braille, that the occipital lobe is what lights up. And that's how we know that that's happening without cutting open the person's brain. So that's allowed us to find out a lot of stuff about what's happening in our brain in people, for example, who Yeah. Before, we couldn't have known that because we have no way of measuring it. And it's much more precise than, say, putting EEG wires on a person's scalp, which is very imprecise. Even so, what we have with brain imaging is still limited by the fact that it's indirect and it's not as fast as we think. There's a several-second lag. So when people do brain imaging and they ask you to do something, there's a certain impreciseness, a little bit of guessing going on. To put it simply, you do have to be aware of over-interpreting what you can learn from brain imaging.
That actually relates directly to the plasticity stuff we were talking about, because using these methods, you can actually see that, hold on, here's a different area of the brain that's active compared to what we expected.
And that's how, for example, the people doing stroke rehab have been able to prove that their methods are causing changes in the brain. I mean, clinically, they were showing results, but people were saying, oh, it's just recovery of the area, that it wasn't really dead or whatever. It was only through brain imaging that they were actually able to prove conclusively that it was new areas doing old tasks rather than recovery of the stroked area. So that's an example of the significance.
How is the brain imaging that we're doing today different from what we were doing, say, 10, 20 years ago?
The most obvious difference is what we call resolution, which means that they can see smaller areas, sharper pictures. As a physician, when I started out, if we were looking at a CT scan, about the only thing we could really appreciate was whether or not there was bleeding in the brain. We couldn't really see little teeny pieces. Now, we can actually see a kidney stone, which can be like, a teeny little dot on a CT scan because the resolution of CT scans has gone up. With MRI, the resolution goes up to another level because they can now tell the difference between tiny differences in density of parts of the brain. And this is important because the density changes according to whether the blood flow is high or low. So, and like I said, MRI, functional MRI, is all about blood flow. That's important because when you see a picture in a magazine and it shows an area, it says, this is lighting up. When they say lighting up, and they always that colors and all those are just created by the computer. Those don't exist in real life. Those are just those pictures are created by the computer to help people interpret the information. But when they say something's lighting up, they're really just telling you that the signal is stronger, implies more blood flow to the area that's lighting up. And we're assuming that blood flow means more activity. Even that is a simplifying assumption.
Is it always going to be blood flow? Because we were talking about the synapses before and the chemicals that affect that. Do they relate to blood flow, or is it just an electrical signal? So what I'm asking is there a difference to measurements with brain imaging from blood flow to measurements of brain imaging with electrical impulses?
The brain imaging that we have now is not created by the actual impulses. Yeah, we don't have the ability to scan at that level of resolution yet. The only way we currently have to do that would be to put electrodes inside the brain. And the only time that would be done in a person would be if they were being prepared for a surgical procedure and they were opened up and they put electrodes, you know, to figure out where they don't want to cut. So that's what I meant when I say the imaging is currently indirect. It's indirect because we're assuming that the blood flow is what we call a surrogate marker for brain activity. And I'll give you an example of why this is imperfect. Think back on what we're talking about how it's easier to do things you're familiar with than things that you're not familiar with. Well, it's logical to assume that perhaps doing the same activity when it's something new to you might cause you to use more blood flow then later on when that thing is something familiar to you. We don't really know how much of a difference that makes. So that's a possible confounding variable in trying to, you know, measure, oh, this makes this part of the brain more active when you're doing this.
On a final note, where would you like to see the technology for brain imaging going? Is there something that is a big gap in the market?
Well, the people that I know that work in this area want two things. They want the resolution to be even better than it is now, because even as we are at the level of resolution that they're at now, and I can't tell you the exact, you know, size of it, but it still represents probably thousands, if not millions, of neurons in that little spot. So they want to get it down to being able to see smaller and smaller areas. And time is the big one, because as I mentioned before, there's a lag between what they measure and when the thing happened. Mm-hmm. So you can't, even though you get this impression from when the pictures you see in magazines, you're not really looking at real time in the present yet. There's still, I think it's several seconds. I'm not an expert, so I don't know the exact numbers. So figuring out how to make the measurements faster with less time lag, I think is one of the things that they're working on too.
All right, then. Well, thank you very much for that, Dr. Campbell. One final question. ER, Scrubs, or House?
I hate House, because although I could say, well, I mean, the guys that act anything like that are annoying enough in real life, but you couldn't really get away with acting like that. And I think that there's enough problems with the doctor-patient relationship these days without a character like House. I guess I'd have to go for, and Scrubs, I mean, that's just a comedy. I guess in the end I'd have to say I go for ER, because since I've been, although I haven't watched it in years, as an ER physician, when it started, I was afraid people were going to come in with unrealistic expectations, figure out my disease in 5 minutes, because it doesn't work that way in real life. But the effect of ER actually has been that now people come into the ER and they understand that being an ER doctor is a real job, and they don't ask me what I'm going to be when I grow up anymore.
That's good. And I actually think I haven't seen it since George Clooney's days, but that's been a while.
Well, to me, watching it was too much like being at work.
I can understand that.
And also, speaking of the superstitions, I once bought these season one DVDs, and one night, and I put it in the thing, and I was watching the very first episode, and about 45 minutes into the very first episode, I got called into work for a doctor who got sick, and that's not something as an ER doctor that actually happens very often at all. I mean, the good thing about being an ER doctor is you're usually off when you're off. And so after that, I was kind of afraid to watch it anymore, even though I knew that was totally illogical. I don't think I've ever even gone back and finished episode one, and that was 10 years ago, maybe longer.
Well, Dr. Campbell, I'd like to thank you very much for your time today, and I've enjoyed having you on the Brains Matter show.
It was great fun.
And that's it for today's show. I'll leave you with a quote from Plato. Wise men talk because they have something to say. Fools, because they have to say something. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right-hand side. You can listen to the episodes from your browser by choosing Flash Player from the links and selecting whichever episode you want to hear from within the player. There's also other information on the site, such as links to articles and news, subscription details, both via iTunes and manually, and voting information. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.